President Biden is giving Venezuelan migrants permission to live and work here in the U.S. Back in Venezuela, times are still tough.
The reality is that people are going to continue to try to leave Venezuela unless there's a change in the democratic situation there.
Catholics in Western Ukraine are frustrated with Pope Francis, and that's not entirely new.
Being kind of disappointed by a lack of support from the Vatican, or just being disappointed by the Vatican's priorities not matching.
I'm Carol Hills. The India Club in London opened its doors in 1951, and there's no place quite like it.
Today, London has, I don't know, hundreds, thousands of Indian restaurants. That's not why we go to the India Club. We go to the India Club just to be.
The iconic restaurant is saying goodbye. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. Members of his own party have been calling for it, and late yesterday, President Biden announced that he's giving hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans already here in the United States legal permission to live and work in this country for 18 months. Fellow Democrats from New York have been expressing their frustration with the Biden administration about this for weeks, among them the mayor of New York, Eric Adams.
A crisis that is created nationally, we're looking at a local city to solve it. Is that what you're trying to say to me?
Venezuelans have been fleeing their home country in huge numbers for years. For more about what's going on in that country right now, we're turning to Laura Dibb. She's with the Washington Office on Latin America and joins us from Washington. Laura, what's your reaction to this news from the Biden administration for Venezuelans in the U.S.?
This designation, redesignation for temporary protection for Venezuelans is very important. It protects them from removal, and it guarantees employment authorization for individuals in the U.S. that has been here before July 31st of this year. And this additional designation could result in almost 500,000 of Venezuelans who might be eligible under the redesignation of Venezuela.
And is the assumption that those numbers you're talking about are all Venezuelans who've come here in recent years?
Yes. In the past 6 years, over 7.7 million people have left the country, and that represents just around 26% of the population. The situation in Venezuela right now, it's very complicated, and people are going to continue to flee even without the TPS. This is why such a measure that would allow them for protection and access to authorization to work is so important.
What's the economic outlook in Venezuela right now? Are things the same, getting better, getting worse?
I don't think they're getting better. According to the Venezuelan Observatory of Finances, by August of this year, the interannual inflation rate was 422%, and the monthly inflation rate was 13.6%. The economic situation for most Venezuelans is very complicated because the minimum wage is around $5, but the basic amount of money that a family needs to feed themselves is around $500, which means that you would need 100 minimum wages just to cover like the basic needs of a family.
I know there are elections coming fairly soon in Venezuela. How much faith do you have in that process for improving the daily lives of Venezuelans?
Well, the reality right now is that Venezuela is facing an authoritarian regime. There are presidential elections supposedly in 2024 and regional, local, and parliamentary elections in 2025. Additionally, the opposition is holding a primary election to select the candidate that is going to face Maduro in 2024. And those primary elections are scheduled for October 22nd of this year. Even though the situation is very bad and it seems like there's no hope, the electoral pathway continues to be a way out, and it continues to be a pathway in the context of a democratic and peaceful solution.
The new temporary protective status that was just announced by President Biden, it only applies to Venezuelans who arrived here before July 31st. How will that policy influence Venezuelans who have come since July 31st?
The argument that the states use is that if they open it up, then people are going to continue to flee and and this is going to work kind of a call for migration. The reality is that people are going to continue to try to leave Venezuela unless there's a change in the democratic situation there. The truth is that people that continue to arrive are not going to have access to a job authorization. And it is important also to stress how dangerous the pathways are to come to the United States, people that are crossing the Darien Gap, and try to prevent that from happening.
Laura Dibb is the Venezuela director for the Washington Office on Latin America. She joined us from Washington. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
Moroccans continue digging victims out from this month's 6.8 magnitude earthquake in the Atlas Mountains. The death toll now stands at nearly 3,000 people. Many more have been left homeless. The government has so far only accepted aid from a handful of countries, but Moroccans living overseas are trying to help. That's not always easy, as the world's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Spain has the second largest Moroccan diaspora in the world. What the Moroccans don't have is a national group to help with things like disaster aid. So those here who want to help earthquake victims are turning to their neighborhood mosques. A woman knocks at the door of this one in Barcelona's old city just before midday prayer. She's dressed in black, wearing a hijab. She hands the mosque director, Mohamed Fouki, 30 euros in dog-eared bills. She bids him well, then leaves. Every day, says Fouki, people swing by to drop off something, from cash to cleaning products. As the local imam calls people to prayer, Fouki shows me the earthquake relief supplies he's been stockpiling in an empty classroom. There's tons of stuff here, boxes of toothpaste, shampoo, diapers, some energy shakes donated from a pharmacy. But missing is one item the Moroccan government says victims urgently need, tents. Tents, Fouki says, shaking his head. Very few people have them. Why would they? Around here, no one goes camping, he says. Yet winter is approaching in the Atlas Mountains, and earthquake victims need shelter. Prioritizing materials is hard in the aftermath of any disaster, as is figuring out how to deliver the aid. Moroccans are shipping by plane, boat, even driving their own cars south to the border. One NGO in Barcelona is trying to coordinate all of these individual efforts, but it's tough.
Bueno, intentar organizar un poco el caos, ¿no? Porque no hay una organización muy buena.
I'm trying to organize the chaos, says Mohamed Alami. He runs Friends of the Moroccan People, known by its Spanish acronym, ITRAN. Alami says there's a lot to tackle, from finding trucks and boats to take aid across the Straits of Gibraltar, to avoiding sending things that won't make it in. For example, medicine, he says. It won't get through customs and just creates a bottleneck at the border. Alami spends his days frantically searching for transport and getting customs clearances. At the same time, he's sending a volunteer to drum up support from the dozens of mosques around Barcelona. On a recent evening, I tag along with ITRAN volunteer Ahmad Asusi. He pops into a large mosque in the nearby town of Cornellà. Taking off his shoes, Asusi introduces himself to the imam. He explains ITRAN's efforts. We'll soon have a free truck at the ready, he says, plus all the border paperwork in order. But the imam, who won't give his name, just shakes his head. He says he's got a bunch of tents, but I don't want to hear about trucks, he says dismissively, or even talk about trucks at all. Why, I ask him. Because you always have tons of problems, he says, trying to enter Morocco. He says he prefers to send aid by plane. Asusi leaves frustrated. He says he feels like he's been brushed off, when all he's trying to do is get everyone to work together. Meanwhile, he says Moroccans in the earthquake zone are waiting in the cold. When you see people just sleeping on the ground with nothing, that hurts, he says, as we drive back to Barcelona. I see the images and I start crying, he says. I've told my wife I'm going to go and bring back a little boy or girl. She says, why would you do that? I said, well, some of them no longer have their mom and dad. Asusi's clearly feeling helpless, impatient. But things are slowly inching forward here. ITRAN president Mohamed Alami has just sent me a voice memo from inside a warehouse downtown. He's happy because he's just secured it for free. Now, various mosques can store relief supplies here, he says, coordinate together. And if all goes well, he says, we can load a truck and send it to Morocco within days. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
For generations, it's been the spot in central London to grab a masala dosa or a fish curry. But sadly, the famous India Club is closing its doors. It's a restaurant that was closely associated with India's independence movement. Smita Tharoor has a personal connection to the restaurant. She's a motivational keynote speaker, and her father, Chandran Tharoor, was one of the founders of the restaurant. Smita Tharoor joins us from London. Smita, describe the restaurant for us and why it was a unique dining experience in London.
It was actually much more than a dining experience. It had two floors, and I'm even upset to say had rather than has. On the first floor was, for want of a better word, the club, and we're not talking about anything posh or fancy. A lovely 1950s environment where you could buy a pint of beer or a glass of wine and have some samosas and just sit. And then if you were really, really hungry, you could go a floor further up to the restaurant where you could have lunch or dinner. And as you correctly said, masala dosa, which is also extremely unusual for a club that started in 1951, purely because you did not get Kerala food in restaurants in 1951.
And Kerala, of course, is a state in southern India.
Yeah, exactly. And Krishna Menon, the first High Commissioner to Britain from India, was one of the founder members of the India Club. And Krishna Menon was from Kerala. So when the India Club was founded, he insisted very wisely to have Malayali cooks or cooks from Kerala who knew how to make doshas when he missed his home-cooked Kerala food. My father, as you correctly said, was one of the founder members. He lived in London from 1949 to 58. He would organize events there. He, for example, wrote a satire about the Brits called the Autumn Thullal, which is a Kerala dance satire, and then performed it in front of Krishna Menon, the High Commissioner in the India Club. There were just so many things that happened there. It was a home away from home for Indians. It was owned by the India League, we should also add. And the India League was created in the 20s to gain independence from the Brits.
Well, I was going to ask you that because I wondered, what's the connection between the restaurant and India's independence movement?
Oh, well, there you go. So that's the story. So the India League was an organization that was created to get independence from the Brits. And in 1947, India became independent from the Brits. The India League still very much existed in London, in Britain. And so they said, let's find a place to create a home away from home for the Indians.
I understand there are photos of all sorts of dignitaries who've gone to the India Club. Whose photos are on the walls?
Well, certainly the President of India visited the India Club, and I donated some photographs to the club, which is now on their wall. Well, will be if they get another place, but was on their wall until a few days ago. And the president is there. There are other photographs that I have of one of Lord Mountbatten. Now, you may not know who that is, but Lord and Lady Mountbatten were the last viceroys of India, part of the British Empire. So there's a picture of my mother having tea with Lord Mountbatten. I mean, it's another world.
So let's get to the important stuff. What's the best thing to eat at the India Club?
Well, as an Indian would say, it depends whether you're veg or non-veg. And for those of you who don't know what I mean, are you vegetarian or do you eat meat and chicken and so on? Now, I'm non-veg, so I would certainly advise a chicken bhuna, which is brilliant. Also, the lamb dish is superb. Within the veg, I love the bengan, the brinjal, the aubergine, the eggplant, depending on which country we're speaking in. I love the okra, the bhindi, all of it, really. But it isn't about the food, though. We don't go there for the food. I mean, today London has, I don't know, countless, hundreds, thousands of Indian restaurants, including specifically Kerala-only food restaurants. That's not why we go to the India Club. We go to the India Club just to be part of history. And then if you're hungry, sure, go ahead and have something to eat.
Smita Tharoor is a motivational keynote speaker. Her father, Chandran Tharoor, was one of the founders of the India Club in London, which closed this past weekend. Thanks so much, Smita.
Pleasure.
Just ahead, the friction between Ukraine and Poland. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Poland has been steadfast in its support for Ukraine, and that's why the Polish Prime Minister is getting a lot of attention after saying this.
Żadnego uzbrojenia na Ukrainę z tego względu, że my teraz sami się...
Mateusz Morawiecki was speaking on television yesterday, saying that Poland would no longer send weapons to Ukraine. The reason he gave? Poland's armed forces are in the process of upgrading to modern weaponry. But some say the move is related to Ukrainian grain exports and upcoming elections. Marcin Zaborowski is the policy director at GlobeSec, a think tank in Bratislava, Slovakia, that focuses on security issues. I asked him why Poland is cutting off weapons to Ukraine.
Poland is not cutting out weapons to Ukraine. Poland basically gave Ukraine whatever it could have given. And it will continue to offer its logistical facility to serve as a hub for the donations and support of aid from any other countries, from the United States and Europe to Ukraine. But it doesn't have at this moment enough post-Soviet equipment to donate to Ukraine. And these donations have indeed, they have reached their limits. And simply, you know, there isn't that much enough in the Polish stocks at this point in time to defend the country itself. So that's why the Prime Minister is saying, you know, we have no more to donate. We have to rearm ourselves now.
So this whole grain controversy, how is it connected to the announcement that Poland will now stop weapons transfers to Ukraine?
It's connected only in context, really. It's not directly connected at all. Basically, the relations between Poland and Ukraine at the moment have become a little bit tense because of this grain disagreement. So at the time when the Ukrainian ports have been affected and Ukraine is no longer able to export grain, the route via Poland were the most important one for Ukraine. And Poland was okay with that. And actually facilitated a great deal of that. But what happened, instead of just transfer, a lot of this grain was actually ending up in Poland itself and being sold at very competitive prices at the markets in Poland. Poland is in the midst of its parliamentary election, and the countryside and farmers are essential to, you know, the continuation of the current government. It will really potentially change Polish politics. And the consequence of that was some escalation of this grain debate. Then the Ukrainians responded to that escalation by suing Poland and banning the import of Polish vegetables. And the whole thing led to eventually quite nasty exchanges, as you can imagine. And at some point, when the Prime Minister was asked about, you know, are we not doing enough for the Ukrainians? So he responded the way he responded, by saying that we will no longer be providing Ukraine with arms from the Polish army. There will no longer be any donations. Yeah.
Were there any protections put in place to protect Polish farmers during this time?
When the Polish farmers started protesting very loudly about that, then Poland petitioned the European Commission, and a deal was reached whereby the sale on the Polish, Slovak, and Hungarian markets were no longer permitted. Still allowed for the possibility of transit, but transit via Poland would be escorted by the border guards, and then the grain would be shipped to other countries, but would not stay in Poland itself.
Marcin Zaborowski is the policy director for GlobeSec, a think tank in Bratislava, Slovakia, that focuses on security issues. Marcin, thanks so much for all of this.
Thank you very much.
Long lines are forming at the U.S.-Mexico border again. At the San Diego-Tijuana crossing, so many people are claiming asylum that the U.S. Border Patrol can't process them fast enough. Migrants, many traveling with their children, are being held between two border fences in a no-man's land. Gustavo Solis of KPBS reports from the San Diego border.
It's written all over their faces. They're tired, hungry, and desperate. Hundreds of migrants, including many small children, are sleeping outside in a makeshift migrant camp on the U.S. side of the southern border. Maria says the cold and mosquitoes kept her and her one-year-old son up all night. She stayed in the camp for 3 days and two nights before Customs and Border Protection transferred her to another facility. Had she known just how miserable this would be, she may not have fled Mexico. Maria left her home state of Michoacán after a local gang kidnapped her son. She asked us not to use her full name, out of fear that her son's kidnappers would follow her to Tijuana. Most of the southern border along San Diego has two barriers, a primary and secondary wall. The area between the walls, which is on the U.S. side, is commonly referred to as no man's land. This is where CBP created a makeshift camp to house the large numbers. There's no infrastructure in this section of the border, no roads, buildings, electricity, or plumbing. Migrants told KPBS that Border Patrol agents give them some water bottles, cheese, and crackers. Everything else comes from volunteers in San Diego. Adriana Jasso is with American Friends Service Committee. She says people in the camp come from all over the world.
We have people from West Africa. We have people from Northern Africa. We have people from different Asian countries, including Vietnam and some parts of China. We just met people from Afghanistan, a big family with several small children.
Volunteers pass fruits and other food to migrants through small gaps in the border wall. They also have blankets, medicine, diapers, menstrual pads, and phone chargers, all things that migrants are not getting from Border Patrol. Jasso says that the phone chargers are in particularly high demand. Volunteers run gas-powered generators to charge the phones 24/7. Without them, migrants would have no other way to communicate with loved ones back home. Earlier this year, the Biden administration introduced a mobile app that was meant to prevent these types of camps along the border. The CBP One app allows asylum seekers to make appointments to enter the U.S. Everyone in the camp interviewed by KPBS said they tried to use the app, but couldn't secure an appointment. Maria waited 2 months before deciding to cross the border illegally and turn herself in to Border Patrol agents. Others reported glitches or couldn't use the app because of language barriers. Nancy is an indigenous woman from Ecuador. She also asked that we don't use her full name.
Muy triste, cansada. Estoy en camino ya 2 meses. Y aún no paso todavía, pero confío en mi Señor.
It took her and her husband 2 months to get to the U.S. border. She prays that their suffering ends soon. In an effort to clear the camp, CBP has dropped off hundreds of migrants in transit centers throughout San Diego County. Local shelter operators say people didn't have any possessions and hadn't showered in days when they arrived. Jasso says volunteers will continue to hand out food and supplies to those in the camps. She encouraged other San Diegans to help out.
If people are moved by the images and the faces that we have been seeing for the last week or so, they are free to come and see for themselves.
Volunteers are asking people to donate small fruits like oranges and apples because they can be passed through the border wall very easily. For The World, I'm Gustavo Solis in San Diego.
You're listening to The World. The mountains of Freetown, Sierra Leone used to be covered in green.
Literally just growing up in forests, you know, everywhere was forest. And in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen so much of that disappear.
How Freetown's new mayor is taking on deforestation and climate change. That's still ahead today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Pope Francis sparked some anger when he joined a video conference with a group of Russian youth last month. During his remarks, he praised Russia's imperial history, mentioning Peter the Great and Catherine the Great, and he told the young audience that they are, quote, the heirs of the great Mother Russia. Those comments did not go over well in Ukraine, especially with Ukrainian Catholics. The Vatican quickly responded, saying that the Pope's intention was to encourage these Russian youth to find value in their culture, not to glorify imperialism. Still, the episode put a spotlight on Ukraine's Greek Catholic Church and the diplomatic role these Catholics would like to see the Vatican play during a time of war. Lydia Tomku has the story from Lviv in western Ukraine.
Saints Peter and Paul Garrison Church is packed during a recent 11 a.m. weekday mass, which is followed by a funeral for Ukrainian soldier Sidhi Stelmakov. As the casket leaves the church, everyone kneels on the ground to pay their respects. Taras Mikhailchuk is Father Superior at the church and head of the Center of Military Chaplaincy.
The war is terrible, very terrible. There are soldiers dying every day, Ukrainians dying every day. Faith helps very strongly.
The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is an Eastern Catholic Church with more than 5.5 million followers in Ukraine. The Pope is the head of the church, but Ukrainian Greek Catholics retain their own historic traditions and their priests are allowed to marry. As a military chaplain, Father Taras has visited frontline locations and his own brother is serving in the military.
I understand as a priest that burying a soldier should not be hard. It should be a big privilege and honor for you as a priest to be the one who prays before the body of the person who gave his life for mine.
There are days Father Taras sees burials, weddings, and christenings in his Baroque-style church. Greek Catholic churches were closed in 1946 when the Soviets took over Western Ukraine and banned the church. The church only became legal again in 1989, says Anna Bisikalo, a PhD candidate at Harvard University who studies the history of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church.
There's also not just a history of being repressed by the Russian Empire, but also of being kind of disappointed by a lack of support from the Vatican, or just being disappointed by the Vatican's priorities not matching Greek Catholic priorities.
That's why the Pope's recent comments about Russian history deeply upset many people and caused the head of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, Sviatoslav Shevchuk, to issue a response, saying the Pope's examples of Peter I and Catherine II are the worst example of imperialism and extreme Russian nationalism. The Pope later clarified that he was not thinking of imperialism when he made the remarks. Since then, Greek Catholic leaders have met with the Pope in Rome.
This is likely to continue to be a tense topic, and I understand if the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church needs kind of more explicit assurances from the Vatican and from Pope Francis that he supports their cause.
Next to a busy cafe at the Ukrainian Catholic University in Lviv is a display of Russian military hardware. It's a reminder to students passing by that their country is at war. University Vice Rector Miroslav Marinovich says 23 soldiers who were in some way connected to the university have died in the war. Marinovich was a prisoner during Soviet times due to his human rights activism. He expects his church to speak more powerfully at this moment.
Russia subverted this international order, ruined it. And it would be important for me to hear what is this moment for the church? How would Jesus explain what is going on?
For Yuri Pidlisny, chair of the political science department at the Ukrainian Catholic University, the Pope's comments were painful and come after other controversies and missteps, including having a Ukrainian and a Russian participate together in an Easter procession, which the Ukrainian government said equated the victim and the aggressor.
I think he has probably good pastoral ends in his mind, but what is he doing is absolutely anti-Ukrainian, I would tell, even pro-Russian.
At the same time, Pidlisny thinks the Vatican can play a role in the war and it would be good for the Pope to visit Ukraine. Two Ukrainian Greek Catholic priests are currently missing and thought to be held by the Russians.
Vatican can play an immense role, and indeed, Vatican is playing this, and quite successfully, in many, many fields. What was successful, for example, participation of Vatican and personally of Pope Francis in the liberation of Ukrainian war prisoners.
Ukrainians, even those who are not Catholic, have long seen the Vatican as a moral force, says Anatoly Babinsky, a research fellow and lecturer at the Institute of Church History at the Ukrainian Catholic University.
They wanted to hear moral judgments, moral assessments of what is happening. So they wanted to hear not what is possible, but what is just.
Since 2014, Saints Peter and Paul has devoted a corner of its church for an installation that shows the horrors of war, including parts of weapons. Today there are rows and rows of photos of fallen soldiers.
We are people who want to be with God, but we are today called to defend our land, our truth, and protect our kids. That's why we're asking for people to be with us until the end, until there's a fair peace.
Father Tadas says Ukrainians are a faithful people and will continue to pray for the Pope and their masses. For the world, this is Lydia Tomku in Lviv, Ukraine.
The annual United Nations General Assembly in New York City attracts a lot of media coverage. That means there are journalists from all corners of the world there. But not all the delegations welcome such close scrutiny. Journalist Kian Amani is with Iran International, based in Washington. As he was broadcasting live outside the Millennium Hilton Hotel in Midtown Manhattan yesterday afternoon, a member of Iran's official UN delegation approached him. The man confronted Amani and threatened him. Amani asked the man to identify himself, but he refused. So Amani started asking him about protesters in Iran who've been killed or arrested. News stories later named the man in the video as a top Iranian security official. Then on Wednesday night, there was another, more serious altercation outside the same hotel.
Don't touch me. Don't touch me.
This time, Kian Amani was filming a group he identified as Iranian officials leaving the Hilton. A man breaks away from the group, approaches Amani, and starts to assault him.
Don't touch him.
Don't touch me.
A woman standing nearby tries to intervene. Two guys who appear to be plainclothes police officers show up. They tell the man to back off and then send him on his way. Kian Amani keeps filming the whole time as the man rejoins the delegates. Tensions in the halls of the United Nations spilling out on the sidewalks of New York. The United Kingdom is hosting the first-of-its-kind Artificial Intelligence Safety Summit. It's scheduled for November at Bletchley Park, where Alan Turing and his colleagues helped break Enigma, the Nazis' secret code in World War II. Top of the agenda, quote, to consider the risks of AI, especially at the frontier of development. We're going to consider those risks for the next few minutes as they apply to people seeking asylum here in the U.S. who know them well. The process of applying for asylum forces people to rely on AI translation tools like Google Translate.
We remember Google Translate circa 2008. We remember that this method had quite a few flaws, had tons of errors, had a ton of misinterpretations.
Andrew Deck is a reporter at the tech publication Rest of World. He was recently a guest on the global security podcast Things That Go Boom, where he told host Lacey Healy that Google Translate and other tools like it have evolved a lot. They're now designed to translate language patterns, essentially mimicking the human brain.
So this is a very sophisticated method, but one that requires a lot of data to do effectively or to do well.
And when it's not done well, the consequences can be bigger than you might think.
In February of this year, when I connected with Respond Crisis Translation, it's a coalition of about 2,500 translators around the world. They have a dedicated team that works in Pashto and Dari, two of the most spoken languages in Afghanistan. And I connected specifically with someone named Uma Merkel.
I am team lead for Afghan languages, for Dari, Farsi, and Pashto.
In 2020, Uma got a message from a Pashto-speaking woman who had fled the U.S. She was asking for help because she just had her request for asylum denied by a U.S. judge.
So in court, the judge, he had asked this asylum seeker something to the effect of, why does this document say that you were with other people, but you're telling me right now that you were alone during an incident that was really important to her asylum claim? And ultimately, the judge decided that there were too many discrepancies in her story and dismissed the asylum claim.
Turns out the aid organization that originally helped the refugee write her documents had used a machine translation tool.
And that tool had swapped all the I pronouns in the application for we pronouns.
When I saw that document, I was totally shocked how that organization play with the future of an asylum seeker or a person who has trauma, and this translation and also the consequences of this translation will make double trauma.
That's a small mistake under normal circumstances, and one we've probably observed in our own use of a product like Google Translate, but in the context of asylum court, it was life-changing for this specific refugee. And arguably, it came down to, the negligent use of a technology that hadn't been built with Pashto in mind or with enough dedicated resources to build it well.
Pashto is not a small language. 40 million people speak it between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And it's not a super online language either. And that might be part of why Uma sees translation apps missing all kinds of things. Certain ways to describe emotions or pronouns or military ranks.
When we receive a document and we receive a translation, we read both of them and we recognize that whether it's translated by affiliated with the human brain or it's a machine translation.
In this particular case, Uma was able to go through her documents and translate them properly so the claimant could file an appeal.
If it were not for Uma, as an extremely competent and qualified and passionate and trauma-informed translator coming in and being able to intervene, we would not have even caught the error, right?
That's Respond Crisis Translation's founder, Ariel Korn.
It wasn't because of this person's story. It was because the machine did not do the job properly. And so this machine would have literally compromised this person's case in an extremely high-stakes scenario. And what we're seeing across the board is that for government contractors, large organizations, hospitals, clinics, it's really across the board, are trying to cut costs by using machines and failing to involve human translators in this work at all. It's not only a form of economic violence, but it is putting the folks who are forced to rely on these machines at risk.
Ariel's critique also applies to the U.S. federal government, where machine translation is becoming a go-to tool without much oversight.
In 2019, ProPublica reported that U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS, officers there were instructed to use Google Translate to vet the social media accounts of asylum applicants.
And that's not all.
We take you down south to our border with Mexico. And while for years it's been predominantly Mexicans and Central Americans trying to come to this nation, in recent months we've seen an uptick in Haitian migrants also chasing the American dream.
Thousands of migrants from Haiti, many of whom began their trek overland as far away as Colombia.
Images of people being corralled by agents on horseback causing a firestorm of criticism.
The U.S. southern border with Mexico has become the touch point for many Haitians trying to get away from natural disasters and political chaos. And when they get there, they're told that the way to kick off their asylum claim is with the Customs and Border Protection app.
And the app itself was, when it was rolled out, not available in Haitian Creole.
Activists in the Haitian diaspora and the translation community fought for the app to be translated into Haitian Creole, and they won. But when it was finally made available, translators say that what it provided was useless word salad.
Sentences where no spaces were used between words. There were no accent marks anywhere. Words were misspelled. Words were mistranslated.
It was obvious to the translators that it was a machine translation. They sat with the app and they tried to find ways to make the incomprehensible comprehensible so people could still try to make their case at the border.
But what the government is basically saying is that if you can't make sense of unintelligible gibberish that is produced by a machine where no human has been involved in order to supervise and oversee, then you can't apply for asylum. That's essentially the message that the government is sending.
And there's a possibility that that's the point. Thousands of asylum claims are denied to people who come to the U.S. border. A translation system that doesn't work can just be one more wall to keep people out. But Andrew Deck says there's also another motivation at play. For government contractors, selling translation machines is big business.
In our own reporting, we've shown that there's a web of for-profit translation providers. They have multi-million dollar contracts with U.S. government agencies, and they regularly advertise their machine translation services, including in Pashto and Dari and other low-resource languages. And we were able to find a paper trail that showed evidence of one company in particular actively pitching their machine translation product for an organization that explicitly works with asylum seekers.
Which could mean more crises like the one that Uma caught at the last moment. A lot more. Because the immigration system is strained. People are waiting, and they need help making sense of their case.
I want to be careful in saying that the demand for translation in the immigration system is very real and it's very urgent. One figure that is top of mind for me in reporting this story was that in December of 2022, in the US, there was a backlog of 1.6 million asylum applicants pending in US immigration courts. And I believe that's a record-breaking number. But I think what we're seeing with machine translation is that it's increasingly becoming a way to cut corners and cut costs in the face of this backlog and, in effect, sidestep the need for capable human translators and interpreters.
That was reporter Andrew Deck on the role of artificial intelligence in processing asylum applications. He was speaking with Lacey Healy for the security podcast Things That Go Boom. Lethal landslides, coastal erosion, annual flooding, and extreme heat. Freetown, the capital of Sierra Leone in West Africa, has them all. The port city of about 1 million people is growing fast. Urban sprawl has led to massive deforestation, and unregulated development has made flooding worse. How Freetown is turning things around is the focus today of our climate solutions segment, The Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Yvonne Aki-Sawyer shot to international prominence when she was first elected mayor of Freetown in 2018 with a plan to transform her city's climate resilience. She's about to return to that role and spoke this morning at the UN General Assembly in New York with the world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
Mayor-elect Aki-Sawyer, thanks so much for speaking with me. You were born and raised in Freetown. Tell me a little about your daily life there now. When you walk or drive around the city, what impacts of climate change can you see?
Like many places, one of the most striking impacts now is extreme heat. This year, the lack of rainfall has been marked, and that comes with all sorts of challenges. Another major impact for my city of climate change, it has, as we all know, really damaging effect on crop cycles, on crop harvest. When you're a subsistence farmer, that means you kind of like live from day to day. What you farm is what you eat and sell, and then you haven't got the stores nor the technology to really have much of a cushion. When your harvests are hit, you often become desolate, and what do people do? Migrate to the city. So we've seen massive rural urban migration. That's added vulnerability to existing vulnerability. And one of the worst impacts of this has been deforestation. So for those of you who don't know, Freetown is the capital city of Sierra Leone, and it's on the Atlantic Ocean. It's nestled between the ocean and a range of mountains. I grew up with those mountains being totally green and literally just growing up in forests. You know, everywhere was forest. And in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen so much of that disappear.
You began a tree planting campaign as part of your efforts to make the city more resilient, plant a million trees. How is that effort going?
So the tree planting program is known as hashtag Freetown the Tree Town. And it's not just planting a million trees, it's growing. To date, we have 850,000 in the ground. And by the end of October, another 250,000. That's taking us just over the 1 million target. Green jobs are created by this. The young people on this program, the young people who work on this program, get paid based on the tracking of the trees. So we created a digital app, a tree tracker app, which is connected to a database. On a regular basis, it's every 2 weeks. They'll be taking a picture of the tree, and that will be monitored, and we do a physical audit. And based on that audit, which is done independently, we've had an 82% survival rate, which is really high for tree planting programs. And that's why we say we're not planting trees, we're growing trees.
I understand that the goal was to have a million trees planted by 2022. You're saying you're going to meet it this year in 2023. What happened there? What went wrong? And are there any lessons learned that you can share from that?
So the reason it went from 2 to 3 was finance. If we had the money, we'd have done it immediately. I mean, of course, you've got some lead time because you've got to nurse the seedlings. But definitely with more finance, we could do more and we could do it faster.
The impact of climate change on Freetown is not unique. As you're talking to mayors from other urban areas, are there secrets to success that you'd share with them?
I would say one of the most important things is take your community along with you. Make sure your residents are informed and understand, because they're your biggest partners. We did this first with Transform Freetown, which is our wider SDG.
Sustainable Development Goals, a UN program.
Yes, of course.
For our listeners.
For listeners, the SDGs are the Sustainable Development Goals. And what was interesting is that we had developed and designed Transform Freetown. And then afterwards, I came across the SDGs, did an alignment, did a matrix, and everything we're doing was meeting one of the SDGs or more, multiple SDGs. So I think what that tells you is that it's about meeting the needs of people. You know, you can use all kinds of acronyms, you can use all sorts of fancy words, all sorts of vocabulary, but if you're just speaking to people and understanding their needs and working to meet those needs, we will tick the boxes of what needs to be done. Have effective communication. You know, I was in a market and the market woman called me, I'm going to say this in Creole, the mamina Facebook, the woman on Facebook. And it's because I speak to my city, I speak to my residents, very active on social media, which is where people are. And of course, we need to build on our revenue base locally, but where we are today, local financing is not enough. We're facing a crisis, and for many countries, many cities in the developing world, it's a crisis we didn't create, and it's a crisis which is coming at us like a tsunami.
I wanted to talk about informal settlements and flooding. Floods are killing people every year in Freetown, especially in the informal settlements or slums. How are you addressing that issue with an eye toward better urban planning?
I think that the most effective thing I could implement is something I am not able to. And this is where I come back to say it's about giving space for mayors as well. So the Local Government Act in our country provided, as you would expect, for the mayor to be able to do urban planning, to issue building permits, to be able to have the tools to prevent this illegal construction and the explosion of slums. That's not the case. We have it in paper, the power. In practice, the Ministry of Lands refuses to allow us to utilize that power. And so nobody does planning permits. And therefore, we just have chaos. So that's the first thing. So what would I do? What would I love to do? I'd love to be able to have a building permit regime so that I can stop people from constructing where they're not supposed to construct and where it's going to make them more vulnerable. But those aren't my powers. So what we do is we work with local communities in flood mitigation, as I mentioned before, in understanding where the flashpoints are, in building resilience, in training them, in having early warning systems, in having community-based disaster risk management committees. So we're building resilience and communicating. That's like putting a bandage on the wound. It's not really the answer. The answer is one that I've been advocating for nonstop, and I'll keep advocating for it. We cannot keep moving forward and expect to have the resilience we need without planning, effective planning, being a part of that equation.
Mayor-elect Yvonne Aki-Sawyer, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Aki Sawyer spoke with the world's Carolyn Beeler this morning on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York. And that's the world for this Thursday. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.